Und jetzt geht's in den Trakt. Ein enormer
Trakt. First question. This talk will be chiefly about what is this and why it's interesting. Canonical general relativity is formulated on a space-like microsurface. And here we consider data instead of piecewise known hypersurface. By Peter Fowler, I mean knowledge that the normal vector is lifelike. And specifically, of course, there are various such hypersurfaces that we consider, but this is not two. The most obvious one is a light cone, which is known everywhere except for the surface. But I will consider another type. I think we have time, which is two intersecting known hypersurfaces. So, like an open book, for that. So it consists two known hypersurfaces in the intersection of a space like. Two surfaces. There's a picture of one dimension section in a four dimensional space time. No hypersurface will be this solid cylinder. So it's can also be thought of as the hypersurface swept out by no rays emitted normally from this two-dimensional space-like two surface. And this initial data on the concept of hypersurface, of course, specifies a maximal Cauchy development, which occupies a region more or less like the one I've shown. And the space of such Cauchy developments you can think of as the phase space. So, the main subject of why do this? Well, first of all, there's a big technical simplification. You're quite familiar with it. The strings that are the main thing that you're always working with in the space type canonical theory. Well, here, you can solve all the constraints explicitly if you want. And in any case, you can certainly identify three initial data. That's data you can specify without any constraints on it. Every data set corresponds to the solution. And completely defined. So that would be the complete initial data. And this was discovered already in the early 60s by independently by a number. Another interest, that's just a technical advantage, which is sort of the basis of the other advantages of some of those. Another is that it provides a more natural setting, I think, to describe observables, at least observables like the ones we actually use, because there are descriptions for defining fully if you want to compare the observables in general relativity, often involving a scale of field or some sort of matter to label, to provide a physical coordinate system, if you will, to define the regions in space on which you then measure geometrical properties. But such observables are lovely, but they're observables for a space time full of this matter. At least microscopically, we deal with the limited space time or space which is mostly infinite. And our observables we actually have reflect us. We have perhaps the prototypical observable kind of thinking is an astronomical observation. There is some matter involved for the actual problem. Of course, there's matter involved, but there is the actual telescope that fixes a point in a region in space. But then you make use of the propagation of light waves across basically empty space from some faraway regions of this telescope. And so in this formalism, the light rays are very naturally incorporated. And indeed, I recently found out that Ellis and a whole bunch of collaborators have already shown that the sort of data, the three data I mentioned, not for these surfaces that I'm talking about, but for an analogous case, which is the light cone, three data specified in the light cone, correspond, each of these items of data corresponds to the results of idealized astronomical measurements. So there's quite a close connection, it seems, between the data and the actual observables. And then there are another nice thing, I think this is nice, perhaps from a philosophical point of view, is that this way of doing things, the non-hypersurfaces, seems to force you to, and allow you, is to have a point of view rather similar to algebraic field theory. You cannot, in fact, have these null hypersurfaces extending to infinity, because if you make even a small change, if you make some excitation in the gravitational field, then the null rays that null rays that trace out the null hypersurface will cross or reach a constant. And so you have to, at least if you want to use a formalism in which these null rays nicely rule the surface, so to say, then you have to cut off the hypersurface before you get to the constant. So you have to work with a finite hypersurface. Otherwise you can't have any actual excitations of the gravitational field in the phase space. That wouldn't be the trivial phase space. So this forces you to work quasi-locally, the phase space that only reflects the gravitational field in the region, or a diamond for you, or the algebraic field for you, say, I think. And I think that's very, very attractive because you separate out. You don't have this built-in absolute causality that you have in the case of a space like hypersurface extending to infinity. You can't have time-like curves and so on. Of course, you might say that that's nice if you want to have time-like curves, but it seems a little bit against the spirit of general relativity that you build in from the beginning this aspect of the global structure. Here you don't have that. Here you only talks about observables in a finite region, and then you can incorporate dynamics by specifying the relations between data on hypersurfaces that have overlapping domains of dependence. And the final reason, which originally motivated this a lot, is the entropy balance, the holographic principle. I said about this looking for to see if there was some sort of first principles proof or at least first principles way of understanding how we could have a holographic principle in general relativity. So I'm going to talk about that. First I'd like to very briefly and sketchily review the photographic escalators. Or, no, not of the nature of the artist. So there's the Frankenstein mount, original one. This is a version of it, which isn't Frankenstein's version of the painting. It's somehow my version of something that Lee says. So I don't want to blame Lee for this. I like it, on the other hand, thank the credit for it. So it says roughly this: object inside a sphere of area A, in stationary area as in part of the black space-time, cannot have more entropy than a black hole is on the same area. And the argument is more or less runs like this, that you can imagine collapsing a spherical shell of matter around the object so it becomes a black hole, and you can imagine doing this sufficiently gently and so that there's no significant amount of radiation emitted, and so the entropy of the rest of the universe doesn't increase significantly. So if you believe in the second second law of thermodynamics, the initial entropy has to be less than the final entropy, and the final entropy, well, the generalized entropy is equal to the entropy of the black hole. Okay. So this is not the most general version. It's a more general version of this problem, which is a little bit more abstract. Russo bound. And that says it's set in an environment that is similar to the one I started describing for the non-canonical or the non-canonical theory. And that is, you have a null hypersurface swept out by long waves emerging normally from a space like two surface again. And you suppose that this two surface is not convex, or what is essentially that, more specifically, that they're not diverging at the point of emission. And you truncate the two surface, so the hypersurface, the null hypersurface, before the rays have a positive cross the surface. And the claim is that the entropy on this hypersurface is less than the area of the two surface from which the rays are emerging originally, divided by 4 in time units. So less than the entropy of a black hole or through that area. Of course, this brings to mind a few questions. What is the entropy of a null hypersurface? But I should maybe say before going on. So this extends the principle to dynamical space time transition. It extends it quite a bit from many times. So what is the entropy of such a surface? Well, you can define it at least in one case, that is, if you have matter that is locally in equilibrium, so that it's not necessarily global in equilibrium, but everywhere you can define a temperature and a pressure, and you can define also, in that case, an entropy current, for current. And the entropy is interpreted to be, in that case, the flux sent to the flow current across this free surface, strong free surface. And within this interpretation, Flanagan and a bunch of people proved Russell's bound, assuming an inequality between the stress tensor and the entropy curve. Basically saying that you couldn't have too much entropy without having some stress tensor that goes with it. Which is satisfied for all known matter models. So, in a sense, that shows that it's really quite a reasonable principle for number one. On the other hand, it's not at all a fundamental law, denying this local equilibrium, But you could conjecture a fundamental principle. You could recall that the entropy is equal to the log of the dimension of the subspace of the Hilbert space in the system that is compatible with the thermodynamic state of the macroscopic state of the system. And this log of this dimension always has to be less, of course, than the log of the dimension of the whole Hilbert space. So you can make this conjecture, so obviously it's not at all implied by this, but you can make this conjecture that there is this fundamental principle that there's somehow a Hilbert space of states associated with this hypersurface, and the dimension of Hilbert space has to be less than or equal to the area, the exponential of the area divided by 40. Okay. So this would be very interesting. From the beginning, it seemed that the holographic principle, or the entropy bounds which support the holographic principle, seemed to point to a new clue as to what was talking about. We've been operating with only two clues, two starting points for a long, long time, and not just succeeding. We had almost everyone works from the assumption that if you work with some invariances in the exact case and the things, and that general relativity is the classical linear theory. But those two data aren't enough for us to define a theory. Perhaps they're sufficient, but they're not smart enough to find it. So there emerges this new principle, this holographic principle, that has somehow the smell of a fundamental principle, and it could be a third pillar on which you build holographic. So it's very interesting to see if you can justify, maybe through some semi-classical calculation in terms of relativity, the idea that there's at least this constraint on the dimensionality of the Hilbert space of gravity. Of course, the way I've stated it, it's rather unclear what this Hilbert space is, because classically, a null hypersurface by itself has no domain of dependence, well, except itself, because we can always send in signals that go parallel to the surface, but still over the surface of the hypersurface without being registered on the hypersurface, and yet change however you like, or change in any point outside of the hypersurface the metric. So there's no domain of dependence, it's not no phase space, but you can obviously identify with the phase space. So it's not clear what is the Hilbert space, although So we have this conjecture in any case. Well, you can say one thing. You can imagine, for instance, in two-dimensional space-time, you can make some sense of this idea. If you have a pair of null surfaces in 1 plus 1 space-time, then the data defining the left movers is defined on one, and the data defining the right movers on the other part, the other null surface, initial surface. So you could say that this U provides all the data for the left movers. So in some sense, it has half of the information in the phase space here. So maybe it makes sense to have a Hilbert space associated with that. In any case, you could ask, is there some reason to believe that this, some mechanism whereby this could be true? There is. I should say this is extremely speculative. This is all by way of motivation. The actual work I do is motivated by this, but it's not this. But I think it's nevertheless a valuable thing, and what might be going on. So how could this conjecture be true? How could the filter space dimension be limited by this exponential Well, first of all, it seems impossible. Back in GR, you have an infinity of Fourier modes of data on the surface, no hypersurface. So, if you quantize the linearized theory, some sort of Fock space quantization, then obviously you will have an infinite dimensional filter space. But if you include back reaction, maybe things are different. Remember, so let's consider excitations of the data on the surface, which is localized in some smallish region, that corresponds to some wave, some signal propagating through the region, through the hypersurface, on one side of the other. Let's suppose that this is a quantum theory. So then the quanta should, the energy should be quantized, the energy of each mode, in some finite energy for each quantum. So if you then try, if you have a one of these hypersurfaces in a certain set of these quanta going through it, and you try to stuff one more through it, well, you also apply a flash to this, then more energy goes through the surface, and this will make the generators, these null generators, focus more quickly. So that the last quantum there, that was here, falls right at the end. And so really you have the same number of quanta going through. So you can see a possible mechanism whereby the phase space associated just with this hypersurface the filter space would have a limited dimensionality. So the question, of course, is, well, is this nice? It's a very regular view. Can one make a proof that this, that one would have to find some definition of the filter space and can prove that it has this dimensionality, this messiness? Well, perhaps with non-canonical general relativity, because it's adapted to just this sort of hypersurface. Okay, so, say again, a little bit more detail what it is. So you have these two non-hypersurfaces swept out by the geodesics, fusion rate of non-geodesics coming out normally out of this two surface. And on this hypersurface, just because it is null, the metric has this degenerate form, where the degenerate column or the degenerate row is associated with these null directions. Okay, so really, the line part of this metric corresponds to just this 2x2 matrix. And the data, one of the sets of free initial data that have been proposed was proposed by Ray Sachs. And his data were this part of the metric divided by square root of its determinant that makes it a determinant one matrix, 2x2 matrix, one matrix. In other words, so it has 2 degrees of freedom. Okay, so this, in his data, has to be specified everywhere on U and V. And then he had some more data on this two surface here in the middle. So the statement then, the statement was that this specifies the solution uniquely up to diffeomorphisms in the domain of dependence, and it's free. Any set of this data is corresponds to an actual solution of general. So since they're free and complete, they may include coordinates on the phase space, and space is not computer boundaries. So to have a canonical theory, canonical here I mean in the loose sense that there is a Poisson structure, not that I'm going to use canonical coordinates now. Okay, to have that, I need Poisson practice between. And this is what I've actually worked. Okay, so that turns out that the useful starting point for defining these Poisson brackets is the Piles bracket. Piles bracket is essentially a formulation of the Poisson bracket, which is perhaps the most elegant, the one that has the least extraneous structure involved. So I just explain the definition of the Piles bracket. It's defined between two functionals of the metric, which would be the morphism invariant, and they're such that the support of the functional gradients by the metric are compact. And of course, a Poisson bracket is a function defined at some point. It's a function of phase space. So if you want a value, then you have to specify some point in the phase space where you're evaluating it. So I give a metric. So the Poisson bracket between A and B, or the Piles bracket between A and B, will be a function of the metric at which it's evaluated. So this is some metric evaluated by satisfying this expression. And then to define the Piles bracket, I need an action. And basically, what the Piles bracket measures is the effect on B, quantity E, of adding the quantity A to the action. So that first let's call these two A and B observables. So then you define a modified action, which is the original action plus the first observable A times a constant lambda. And then you can define two modified solutions to the stationary points of this new action. Okay? One of them, the retarded modified solution, agrees with this solution T everywhere except in the causal future of the support of the gradient, functional gradient of A. The region on which A depends on the metric in this region. And in the causal future of this region, the retarded modified solution is different from, can be different from G, but outside of this region is the same. The advanced modified solution is the same thing, but reversed. In the future, it's the same as G, but in the past of the support of the function of gradient of A, it can be different. Okay, so then the definition is very simple. The Piles bracket between A and B is equal to the derivative in lambda of the value of B on the retarded modified solution times the derivative of the value of B on the advanced modified solution. This can also be rewritten, in fact, it's a more general statement in terms of range functions. This is really a analog of the first order perturbation theory. All you need is first order perturbation theory to be able to define it. You might otherwise worry that how do you know that these modified, retarded modified and advanced modified solutions actually exist? Well, you don't need them to exist. You only need that first order perturbation theory approximations to exist. Okay, so this is my basic definition of the Poisson bracket, this Piles bracket. So I want to mention a qualitative feature, and I already tell you a bit about how the bracket is, of the data, that follows what is immediately from this definition. It's clear that the Piles bracket is non-zero only for the surface A and B such that their the support of the function of radius, I call that the domain of sensitivity, that the domains of sensitivity are causally related regions. That is, there exists a causal curve from one of the domain of sensitivity of one of them to the domain of sensitivity of the other. So, we can certainly see very naturally from this that fields of space like stuff are very close to you. In fact, if you consider, you can define simply the fields as space like separated ones, you can define this part of the bracket. And it means that they're unique. Although I only talked about it for observables, which are defined on the ethical region. Okay. Okay, so, but on this null hypersurface, only points on the same null generator are causally related. So this means that the variables that have non-trivial brackets are only variables that live on the same generator. Okay. All of the variables in different generators all cross over from U to each other. And it also means that the variables on U and V almost all cross over from U. The only thing is there are some variables on the actual surface of the intersection, which have non-trivial brackets with variables on U and on V. But so you might hope then that it seems that they're essentially, although not quite, two autonomous phase spaces for U and V. And you might hope that this means that the Hilbert space really has a structure of a product. Well, I don't expect it to be exactly so, but it might be enough to be able to define this dimensionality of surface space associated with this. It also seems that if the dimensionality of the Hilbert space associated with U is finite, then it should be an extensive quantity on this two surface pair. So it should be proportional to the area of the two surface pairs. Well, so I've given a whole talk of quite speculative things, which are all motivation for studying this. And I think that's more interesting in this sort of context, but I don't want you to think that everything I've heard is technical. In fact, none of it is. So I want to show you one preliminary result from this work. So the actual work was finding Poisson brackets. And so here is the bracket between what you might call the principal data, the data that lives on the null hypersurfaces, as opposed to the data that lives on the intersection, the two-dimensional intersection. This is the last one. To be able to see this Poisson bracket in a reasonably economical way, I change variables. So instead of this EIJ, this little modular symmetric matrix, I represent the same degrees of freedom with a C value field that lives on the null hypersurface. Okay? And I change to a complexity Y on coordinates transfers to the generator. So you can say coordinates on the two surface, on the two surface that cuts the generators. And I can replace that with a single complex coordinate. And then I can rewrite the metric in terms of this quantity mu like this. Okay. So this is a way in which I can encode the data in the EIJ in a complex value scalar field. And here are the brackets between them. Mu and mu bar are two different points. Well, the bracket is zero if they're not on the same generator. It has a factor depending on the order of the two points x and x prime, which one is closer to the intersecting surface, changes sign, and all that. And then there are some basically volume factors that make this into as the right dependence under change of coordinates. Right, makes a link, if you like. And finally, the most surprising part, is the space factor. Well, there it is. I don't really know what to say about it, but what's nice is that you can actually explicitly say this result, which is at the same time explicit at the other factor and not at all obvious. The other nice thing is that there's a bracket for mu and mu, so mu and mu bar, and it's zero. So this is interesting. It means that mu defines a complex polarization. At least if we ignore for the moment all the variables that are under the intersection of the two hypersurfaces. And so that seems to me that we should be able to represent quantum states as holomorphic functions of this field mu. Of course, this is only for this variable, and then one has to include in the treatment all the variables in the intersection, and that's not at all unimportant because, we have maybe especially if you suspect that it's a holographic field, certainly variables on two-dimensional surfaces are not ignored. So I do in a sense, but I suppose it's a matter of taste. What I really like about the Parles bracket is that it's quite clear its relationship with the Tommy pairs in quantum mechanics is quite clear. So I from its definition. So I view the use of the symplectic form as justified if it gives the same result as the Parles bracket. But there's a little bit more to the story. It's a rather not all the situation that appears at first, because there is a boundary which isn't it's not an infinity where it's a subset space. It is, you say, a wide boundary in this problem. And so when I try to simply convert the symplectic two form, I found that I couldn't, that there were terms coming from the boundary that I couldn't get rid of. So the question was, what should be the criteria for something being the inverse? Couldn't be simply that it's literally the inverse that you plug it in and you get it, plug it with the Poisson bracket into the symplectic two form, so it has to be somehow softened. What should be the correct notion of inverse? And I had no a priori criteria until I started working with the Parles bracket, and I found that if I what I do is really I define the Poisson bracket on observables using the Parles bracket, and then I require that the Poisson bracket on the initial data introduces the Poisson bracket on the observables. And this gives me a sufficient condition on the Poisson bracket on observables, which is exactly that it is a sort of an inverse of the symplectic two form. It's an inverse modulo certain boundary terms, which I would have had no justification for adopting as a criterion without starting with the Poisson bracket.
Anyone going quick?
How much data is there on that scene for those two molecules?
Well, in the Sachs version, it's the area density. Very good to determine the derivative. It's the derivative in a fine parameter of the area density in two directions. And then there's a fine thing to construct about the connection to both the components called a switch, which is essentially a meter derivative. Okay. Yeah, some kind of extended differential